Good morning.
Good morning.
And New Year's greeting. We've said it many times, so I don't always say happy, but I want to greet you for the New Year. It may be a disaster. That could well be a calamity. So, hope for the right people. That's all I got to say. today, this morning, just now, we had our Bodhisattva ceremony where we acknowledge our karma, our what we sometimes call evil karma. I don't know if all of our karma is evil. I think our karma is what it is. Some of it's good, some of it's bad, depending on our intentions. So we are self-creating beings, and we create ourselves through our actions and our thoughts. So, and this is called karmic action, and the result is karmic result. Good or bad. It's called the law of the universe. It's not determination, not determined. It's simply that we do something and it has a result. So that's why we should be careful of what we do, because it has a result. And the result, if we continue doing what we do, the results follow. So we should be careful. And so in this ceremony that we just did, we acknowledge our karma from beginningless beginning. So we don't say, oh, I did this and that, but we simply acknowledge that we're here, we have what we have, we suffer what we suffer, we enjoy what we enjoy because of our past actions. So in the ceremony, at the beginning of the year, this is the first week of the new year, and so it's a very wonderful way to enter our new year and to think about what we'll do now. So all my ancient tangled karma, we should say twisted, but I think it's tangled. It's all tangled up, you know, it's all interwoven with our destiny, all interwoven with our environment and our our actions and the people that we're surrounded by and how we interact. So I think tangled is good. And sometimes it's hard to get out of our entanglements. Twisted has more of an evil feeling. You know, I don't think all of our karma is evil, but there is an evil aspect, possibly. I think of some people say, well, Buddhism doesn't talk about evil, but actually Buddhism does. And evil has the feeling of, for me, what it means is enjoying the suffering of others. Our actions which cause the suffering of others and gives us enjoyment. So it's perverse. It's a kind of perversity. And it's I feel that there are certain dominant forces that are just in the world, and each one of us is a kind of like a radio, a kind of transmitter. These forces, we tune in to these forces. to run the switch and tune on to the station that, delusion station, anger station, greed station, and then we transmit these broadcasts. We broadcast what we hear, what we feel, and what we induce into our receptacle brain. We're always receiving these forces and transmitting them, and they're called war, epidemic, and ill will, greed, whatever you want, we get caught by them. So there are people who tune into the peace station, and then we transmit peace. And there's the harmony station, we transmit harmony. And then there's the evil station, where we transmit evil. And the hate station, where we transmit hate. And so it's not like we are like that. We are that, but we're just simply transmitting these forces that are always present in the world, and they're always there. We say someday we want everything to be peaceful, but that will never happen because all the forces are continually whirling around. So I think in Buddhists make an effort to create peace in the world. And many religious practices make an effort to create peace in the world. And so we have these communities which are dedicated to creating peace in the world. And throughout the history of Buddhism, this is why we have monastic practices, communities which are divorced from, pretty much avoid the evil forces, so that we don't create evil in the world, which is wonderful. In the lay community, we're more subject to dealing with the evil forces in the world. But even in the monastic community, those are still there. They're very hard to avoid. They're born through greed, hate, and delusion. So, when we acknowledge our ancient tangled karma and acknowledge this includes our evil desires, and it includes our innocent desires, and includes our delusive desires. And then we state or take the precepts again in order to re-enter our dharmic path. So we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Those are the first of the 16 precepts. But they're called three indivisible precepts. In other words, they're one precept that cannot be divided. Although, even though we say Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, those are three, but the three are really one. So, Buddha is Buddha is the first precept, of course, and the other two precepts are expressions of how to be Buddha. Dharma is one aspect of Buddha. Sangha is another aspect of Buddha. So these are the three legs of Buddha. The three legs of the cauldron of Buddha practice. You can say that Buddha is like Dharmakaya, Vairochana. Sangha is Sambhogakaya, Lokchana Buddha. And Sangha is Shakyamuni Nirmanakaya. So what does that mean? It means that Buddha Vairochana is the source. Dharmakaya is the source. Vairochana is the expression of the source. The source of light, actually. The lamp Buddha is called. He, she is called. Lamp Buddha. The Buddha which personifies stillness and radiance within us, actually. Each one of us is actually Vairochana Buddha, our true nature. When we manifest light, it's Vairochana manifesting light. Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, is the expression of Dharma, or the expression of how Dharmakaya Buddha is expressed through Sambhogakaya, which is Buddha's teaching, or wisdom. It's called Sambhogakaya, is our wisdom mind, which is an expression, how we express the Dharma in a true sense. And Sangha is manifestation, my body, my persona, person. My person is Nirmanakaya, the Buddha as expressed as a person. And it's called Sangha. So I am Vairochana, I am Sambhogakaya, I am Nirmanakaya. I am Shakyamuni Buddha. You are Shakyamuni Buddha. You are the person who expresses the Dharma Kaya through the Sambhogakaya. Do you understand?
A question. Is there a Buddha which is a personification of the Sambhogakaya, like Vairochana and Shakyamuni?
Lochana. That's what we say.
That's Lochana.
In a meal chant, right? It's all there in the meal chant.
Yeah.
Lochana is like Amida Buddha.
It's the same?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Buddha of the Pure Land Buddha. The sixth ancestor says, the Pure Land is our own mind. When our own mind is purified, that's called the Pure Land in the West, in the Western region, yeah.
Can we have it a little louder back here?
Okay.
Maxed out.
Yeah.
If you need louder, I can
go
in the deeper electronics or something.
Oh, it's a bit louder.
That works.
And so I start drifting off. Yeah, so purity means non-duality in the Dharma. Where we have something called pure and impure. Our pure actions and our impure actions. But actually, when we transcend both pure and impure, we have purity. When we transcend both good and bad, we have good. We have, because purity is non-duality. So that's hard for us to kind of get, but we get it through practice. So it's hard to stay above getting caught by one side or the other. So I want to talk today about, I'm going to make a commentary on the sixth ancestor's verse from the Platform Sutra of the sixth ancestor on the high seat of the law. Sixth ancestor, as most of you know, we say Daikan Eino in our lineage. Daikan Eino, Daiyo Sho, the sixth Chinese ancestor. Sometimes called in Chinese Wei Long or Hui Nung or So Ke. Many different names actually in Chinese, but Japanese we say Daikan Eino. And I've commented on this before, and some of you may remember, but it's always good to keep going over it because I keep going over it, over and over it myself. There are some texts that I just go over and over, just study over and over, and this is one of the things that I like so much. It's a kind of a poetic gatha. And so the sixth ancestor is talking to his assembly of monks, both men and women, and lay people, both men and women. And he's saying, if you just put this into practice, you don't have to go to a monastery. Just practice this in your daily life, and you'll be one with the Dharma. So he says, one who is a master of the Buddha Dharma and has realized their essence of mind may be likened to the bright sun in an empty sky. One who is a master, whether it's a man or a woman, who is a master of the Buddha Dharma and has realized the essence of mind may be likened to the bright sun in an empty sky. Essence of mind here means Dharmakaya, means the source of our life.
Can you read the whole thing?
Okay, I'll read the whole thing first. It's a little long, but I'll read it first. One who is a master of the Buddha Dharma and has realized their essence of mind may be likened to the bright sun in an empty sky. Such a one teaches nothing but the Dharma for realizing our self-nature, which is their purpose for being in the world and to make people aware of erroneous views. We can hardly classify realization of the Dharma into sudden and gradual. Some will attain realization more quickly than others. The way of realizing the essence of mind is above the comprehension of the comprehension of one who is ignorant. We may explain it in 10,000 ways, but all those explanations may be traced back to one principle. In order to illuminate the dark place of the afflictions, we should constantly set up the light of wisdom. Erroneous views keep us in defilement, while right views remove us from it. But when we are in a position to let go of both of them, both right and wrong, our mind is then pure. Bodhi, which means enlightenment, is imminent in our essence of mind, and to attempt to look for it elsewhere is erroneous. Within our impure mind, the pure mind is to be found. And once our mind is set right, we are free from defilements, evil karma, and karmic retribution. If we are treading the path of enlightenment, we need not worry about stumbling blocks, provided that we keep a constant eye on our own faults. We will not go astray from the right path. Since every species of life has its own way of salvation, they will not interfere with or be antagonistic to one another. Therefore, if we leave our own path and seek some other way of salvation, we will not find it. And if we plod on until death overtakes us, we shall find only regret in the end. If we wish to find the true way, right action will lead it to you directly, will lead you to it directly. But if you do not make effort in the way, you will grope in the dark and never find it. One who treads the path in earnest sees not the faults of the world. If we find fault with others, we ourselves are in the wrong. When others are in the wrong, we should ignore it. For it is wrong for us to find fault. By letting go of the habit of fault finding, we cut off a source of defilement. When neither hatred nor love disturb our mind, serenely we sleep. Those who intend to be the teachers of others should themselves be skilled in the various expedients which lead others to enlightenment. When the disciple is free from all doubts, it indicates that their essence of mind has been found. The pure land of Buddha is in this world, within which enlightenment is to be sought. To seek enlightenment by separating from this world is as absurd as to search for the horns of a rabbit. Right views are called transcendental. Erroneous views are called worldly. When all views, right or erroneous, are let go of, then the essence of Bodhi appears. This stanza is for the Southern School. It is also called the Big Ship of Dharma for sailing across the ocean of existence. Kalpa after kalpa, that means long, long time, a person may be under delusion. But once enlightened, it takes but a moment to realize Buddhahood. So, I'm going to start at the beginning. I may not get all the way through. One who is a master of the Buddha Dharma and has realized their essence of mind may be likened to the bright sun in an empty sky. So, usually we talk about enlightenment as moonlight. The moon is usually the usual metaphor for enlightenment. But here he said the sun. The sun is, it could be the moon or the sun, so I'm not going to quibble with it. So one who is a master, I would say one who is a master of the Buddha Dharma and has realized their essence of mind is the vehicle for light, which is Vairochana Buddha. To allow the light of Vairochana to express itself in the world. That's how we save sentient beings. That's called saving sentient beings, is to allow people to experience their own light, which is covered by greed, ill will, and delusion. So Vairochana is always like the sun, expressing light. But when the clouds move by, we call it the hazy moon of enlightenment. A phrase, the hazy moon of enlightenment, which, you know it's there, but it's intangible, a little bit hidden. You see it, but it's intangible. But when the clouds are there, though, it's wonderful to see the outline of the light behind the clouds, at the edges of the clouds. And empty sky means empty mind. When the mind is empty, the light has an opportunity to shine through. So empty means not getting caught by the loop of worries and obsessions. So such a one teaches nothing but the Dharma for realizing our self-nature, which is their purpose for being in this world, and to make people aware of erroneous views. So that the purpose of a bodhisattva is only this. That's their only purpose. Otherwise, there's no reason for them to be in the world. So when a person takes a vow of to be ordained, that's their purpose in life. Should be their purpose in life. Their only purpose in life is to teach the Dharma for realizing our self nature. So this is called compassionate action. The Bodhisattva vows to save all beings from what? From suffering and delusion. So there's nothing else to do. We're always looking around for something to make us happy. That's why I don't say Happy New Year. We're always looking for something to make us happy. But this is what makes us happy. What makes us happy is teaching the Dharma and saving sentient beings from suffering and delusion. That's the happiest thing you can do. So we can hardly classify realization of the Dharma into sudden and gradual. Some will attain enlightenment more quickly than others. In this time, back in the 6th century, 7th century, early Chinese Buddhism, sudden enlightenment and gradual enlightenment were competing dharmas. So gradual enlightenment is like step by step. You learn this, then you learn this, and then you learn this. Sudden enlightenment is in a moment, everything opens up all at once, and it's all at one piece. So sudden enlightenment is usually more attributed to Zen, right? That's why in Zen we don't start by learning something. We just push you off into the ocean and you start swimming, even if you don't know how. That's why I remember well, it's traditional that you don't greet people and make them feel welcome. They have to fight their way in. Not fight, but find their way in. And that finding their way in stimulates the seeking mind. But we don't do that. We used to do that. But now we have more students because we don't do that. But in a way, you know, it's like it's not kindness. It looks like kindness, and it is, but it's really kind for to not be so welcoming, and to one who has the strong way-seeking mind will find their way in, even with resistance. And this is very typical, traditional Zen. In America, it doesn't work that way so well. You know, the way Master Uman got enlightened was to, he was sure that he wanted to see this master. And so he kept going, knocking on the door and of the master's hut. And the master said, go away, go away. And two or three times, go away, get out of here. He said, I'm not going to let him do that. So he knocked on the door and the master opened it a little bit and he put his leg in the doorway. And the master went and broke his leg. And he woke up. Got enlightened. So they were very rough in those days. So he's saying, you know, we hardly classify the realization of the Dharma as sudden and enlightened and gradual. It doesn't matter. You know, sudden enlightenment is the result of gradual practice. And gradual practice is the basis of sudden enlightenment. So to say which is which, it's not a good argument. That's what he's saying. Even though people always attribute to him that he's the master of sudden enlightenment. So, he said, this way of realizing the essence of mind is above the comprehension of the ignorant. And we may explain it in 10,000 ways, but all those explanations may be traced back to one principle. Well, what's the one principle? The way of realizing the essence of mind is about comprehension of ignorance. Even we explain it, but all those explanations may be traced back to one principle. The principle of selflessness. Of course, selflessness. Selflessness is the basis of enlightenment. That's why difficult practice is difficult, not because your legs hurt so much, but because it's so hard to be selfless. So, and that's what all the teaching is about, is being selfless. But all those, in order to illuminate the dark dwelling place of the afflictions, we should constantly set up the light of wisdom. The light of wisdom. He talks about light, illumination. All the time is light, illumination, and you find that all throughout this. In order to illuminate the dark dwelling place of the afflictions, afflictions are like afflictions of suffering. The elements of our suffering, which we cause through our own greed, our own ill will, and our own delusions. There is suffering, you know, that's caused by outside influences, of course. That's one kind of suffering, but that's not the suffering he's talking about. He's talking about the self-inflicted suffering. We can't... we are always subject to outside influences that press in upon us. But our response to these outside influences is what we do have control over. So we always have to look at our own responses. What is our response? Each one of us is born into a different circumstance. People in Somalia have one circumstance. People in New York have different circumstances. Some people are born wealthy. Some people are born poor. Some people are born under certain restrictions. And other people are born without them. But yet everyone has a problem. Everybody's got a problem. If you're wealthy, you have a problem. If you're poor, you have a problem. It's just different problems. And we can compare those problems and say, boy, I wish I had this problem instead of that problem. But a problem is a problem. And how we relate to what our hand, the hand that's given to us, is our practice. Our practice is based on how we deal with the hand that's dealt to us. So you shuffle the cards and oh, this is yours, this is yours, this is mine. Oh no, that's not the one I wanted. Let's trade. No trading cards. You just got to deal with what you got. Sometimes it's easy, and sometimes it's hard. But the way you deal with it is through selfless practice. That's why, you know, we practice is to not escape, but to be one with the problem. How to be one with the problem? If you have pain in your legs, could be a problem or not, depending on our attitude. It's all about our attitude. If we want to escape, it's called suffering. As soon as you want to escape, you set up the conditions for suffering. When you simply let things be as they are, without judgment, you can find your freedom and your comfort. It's as simple as that, which is not so simple. simplest thing is most difficult. So he says, erroneous views keep us in defilement, while right views remove us from it. You know, we talk about the perverted views, which are also called inverted views. Topsy-turvy, actually, is what it means, upside-down views. Believing in a self, which is topsy-turvy view, because there is no essential self, there is no inherent self. And believing that in permanence, which is, well, there is no permanence, believing that what causes us pleasure, or what, believing that our what we think is pleasure is actually suffering. What we think is suffering is actually pleasure. So, freedom from bondage. We bind ourselves through our attachments. So, right view would be not to mistake one thing for another. Not to mistake suffering for pleasure. But when we are in a position to let go of both of them, our mind is then pure. So that's non-duality. Purity is the non-duality of letting go of all views and simply experiencing everything just as it is. It's not good or bad or right or wrong. Even though there is good and bad and right and wrong. There is good and bad and right and wrong. But wisdom arises when there's no duality between good and bad and right and wrong. And then we can deal with right and wrong and good and bad. So Bodhi is imminent in our essence of mind, and to attempt to look for it elsewhere is erroneous. Of course, we know this, that a Bodhi or enlightenment is intrinsic. And we simply need to remove the hindrances or the obstacles. So within our impure mind, the pure mind is to be found. And once our mind is set right, we are free from defilements, evil karma, and karmic retribution. So within our pure mind, the pure mind is, this is a very important point, impure mind is the mind of attachment. And discriminating mind. We need discrimination, of course. We have to discriminate between things. But if we're caught by discrimination, that's called impurity. So our essence of mind, of course, is the parent of our discriminating mind. If we try to eliminate our impure mind in order to find our pure mind, it doesn't work. This is why we have to find nirvana in our everyday activity. Nirvana is letting go of self-centeredness and letting go of self-centeredness in all of our activity. So that Bodhi or enlightenment can direct our life. It's hard to explain. Even though I have some ways to explain it, it's difficult to explain. How we find release in every moment, given our suffering and our difficult habits. Out within our suffering, we find nirvana. So, renunciation, you know, doesn't mean to take all of your worldly goods and throw them in the ocean. The ocean will spit them back at you. But simply let go, moment by moment. When anger arises, let go. When greed arises, let go. Even though you can't let go. Even though we're stuck in our habits, when we actually make the effort or have awareness, we find some release without finding fault. To just allow ourselves to see ourselves as we are. The easiest way, actually, to change is not to criticize ourselves, but simply to see ourselves as we are. Just to notice ourselves as we are, to really look and see. And even though we can't change, we can see without judging. And that's a kind of release. Because what we're caught by, mostly, is our judgments. Oh, I'm so bad. Oh, I'm so bad. How many of us say, oh, I'm so bad. Oh, I'm so bad. And then we just keep doing this thing. Forget good and bad. Just look at what's happening. Just see it. Okay, this is the way I am. This is the way it is. Okay. And then change happens. Change happens by itself. It's time to stop. But I really want to talk about not finding fault. That's the essence of this whole thing, not finding fault, which is the most difficult thing in your life. Not finding fault with others or yourself. Even though we do have faults. People have faults, I have faults, but not getting caught up in that. Someone said to me, when I was at Tassahara, he said, you know, and he's the kind of guy who's always finding fault. He said, I looked at that guy and I said, I don't like him. And then I looked at that guy and I said, I don't like him either. And then he said, what am I doing? He said, I looked at that guy again and I said, I like him. And I looked at the other guy and I said, I like him. And everything was okay. What was I doing? It's all arbitrary. We think it's not, but it is. Anyway.